Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from our studio in the heart of the 561 West Palm Beach, Florida, where I have regained control of the host microphone. And I'm joined, as always, by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor and last week's host, Zach Anderson.
Welcome back, George.
Thank you. And also from Tallahassee, the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hello, George. I'm glad you're back.
You bet. Now, some of our more jaded and hard to impress listeners might be saying, well, is that all you got? Well, actually, it's not, because joining us today in the studio, we were able to pull a few strings, talk to some people, and we have a special guest with us. Palm Beach Post staff writer Alexandra Seltzer is with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right. We got a whole lot of stuff to talk about this week. We're going to talk about Alexandra's going to talk a little bit about the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation controversy spilling over into local politics. And look at a couple of two of the high stakes congressional races in Florida that are will help determine control of the U.S. House of Representatives. We're going to take a trip down memory lane with Ken Starr of the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky impeachment fame. He was in West Palm Beach recently, weighing in on that and on the current Mueller probe. But first, let's begin with a reality check. Hurricane Michael, they're still recovering bodies. They're still calculating property losses and other damage. There's thousands of people whose lives have been altered permanently by Hurricane Michael. That's the big picture. And the storm's impact on Florida elections and candidates might seem it is a lesser story. But this is a politics podcast, and we're going to talk about that. But we're doing so with an understanding that it's just one part of a much larger story. So we're going to start with John Kennedy in Tallahassee to talk a little bit about the ongoing political impacts and question marks brought on by the hurricane. John, first of all, Tallahassee did not get the brunt of the storm, but it was affected enough that the mayor of Tallahassee, Andrew Gillum, who's the Democratic nominee for governor, spent more than a week off the campaign trail tending to business there. What's the status of Tallahassee, first of all?
Well, Tallahassee is coming back to normal, more or less. There's some isolated power outages still, but most of the city is back to pretty much normal on the grid. And also there's a lot of damage, but nothing devastating like we're seeing in counties just west of here. Basically, those counties out in the panhandle that were really hit hardest by Hurricane Michael, they make up one of Florida's most reliable Republican areas. These are places where Republican candidates have flocked for years to get votes. But this time around, you have Governor Rick Scott, who's running for Senate, and to a lesser degree, Ron DeSantis, the Republican nominee for governor. They're in the panhandle now, really only for relief efforts. But these eight counties that were devastated by Michael, they're home to 220,000 voters. And with the exception of really Democratic heavy Gadsden County, these counties are overwhelmingly Republican leaning. A couple of numbers worth noting. You know, Rick Scott has twice won elections for governor by a single percentage point. And in 2014, the 64,000 vote margin he had over Democrat Charlie Crist, well, half of it was accumulated in the counties now reeling from Michael.
So the by number, and there's what, 13, how many registered voters in all of Florida right now? Is it 13 million or so?
Yeah, just over 13 million. This is a small slice of the electorate, but in elections, as we know in Florida, they're usually pretty wafer thin margins. And these are counties where, you know, Scott beat Crist by margins of 4-1 in Bay County, which is home to Panama City. That's the biggest county effective. 3-1 in Gulf County, 2-1 in Calhoun County. But these voters obviously are now more focused on dealing with massive power outages, homes destroyed, and really the possibility of job losses due to the storm.
Yeah, so I would presume some of those folks have been displaced and might not be able to vote, or that might be a very low priority for them. What's your sense on what kind of effect that'll have on the governor's race and the Senate race?
Well, really, if a share of these voters don't show up this election cycle, it is likely to take votes away from Scott and DeSantis. So, that's a factor right there. Now, Democratic candidates, too, they have something to watch over there in that Gadsden County. Andrew Gillum and Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, they're looking at Gadsden, where for example, 4-1 victory margins for Democrats are common. But that looks really a lot less likely to happen this fall. Now, we have a little bit of sound from Andrew Gillum, who was speaking about just the disparity between, the elections less than 3 weeks away and dealing with the hurricanes. He was speaking about some of the efforts in his home county and also in nearby Gadsden County. Our Joe Forsano has a little bit of tape here that he can run on this.
We've got a whole set of people who are relocating, and my guess is that voting may not be at the top of their agenda right now.
So that's Gillum. He acknowledges the way things are going. Meanwhile, election officials say the election will go on, that even Bay County's election system is back up running after the county's voter registration computer service had to be dismantled and dried out in a sunny parking lot. How's that for technology?
Wow.
But in the end, you got to wonder how many of these voters are going to show up.
Yeah, good. Very good question. Something to keep an eye on. And then, as you alluded to, Gillum was off the campaign trail. Rick Scott has been, I guess, not officially campaigning, but he's certainly been very visible, tending to hurricane relief efforts. I think Nelson and definitely DeSantis have kind of been less visible because of this. Zach Anderson, what are some of the impacts you've seen covering races because of this storm?
Well, just like this storm devastated some communities in the Panhandle, it really threw the election off track here. I think that a lot of the candidates are paused their campaigning for a while. They didn't want to appear like they were, just out there trying to get votes when people were really struggling. And now they're trying to work their way back into the campaigns. Scott made the unusual move of saying that he was going to stay off the trail and have his wife kind of go out there for him. And that's pretty interesting. We'll see, to see how that'll play out, because I don't think we've seen, a candidate kind of wholly leave the campaign trail in the final 2 weeks of the election. I think Scott will probably do some campaigning, but Gillum and DeSantis, it seems like they're probably going to get back into the swing of things over the next week or so. And you already saw Bill Nelson kind of try to turn the page a little bit yesterday with an event focused on Red Tide. I think he would rather not be talking about the hurricane and trying to focus on Rick Scott's environmental record and other issues. The more that we're talking about the hurricane, the more the focus is on Rick Scott's leadership and things like that. So some of these candidates, I think, are eager to move on with their campaigning.
Definitely. All right. Well, that's definitely something to that we will be keeping an eye on between now and the election. But right now, we're going to take a break because I hear some funky royalty-free music playing. Listeners to the podcast know that music means it's time for our pick a number segment, tradition here on the podcast, where each of us are going to mention a number, and then later on we're going to explain what that number means in Florida politics. Why don't we start with our special guest, Alexandra Seltzer. I believe she has come armed with a number. Alex, what's your number?
My number is 14.
14, okay. And again, as always, we do encourage note-taking as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. So if you are taking notes, Alexandra Seltzer with a 14. Zach Anderson, what's your number?
I'm going low today, George. I'm going with number one.
Wow, okay. That's about as low as you can go, although I think we did have zero once on the podcast. John Kennedy, what do you have for us?
George, I've got a 125. 125.
125 for John Kennedy. And I'm going to have the biggest number again. My number is 677,436. So once again, to review in reverse order, George Bennett, that's me, 677,436. John Kennedy, 125. Zach Anderson with the number one. And our special guest, Alexandra Seltzer, with the number 14. You want to hang on and see what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get back to our loaded lineup here. The Brett Kavanaugh confirmation controversy, it's only been a few weeks since he was confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States, but there remains some bitterness over the sexual assault allegations against him and the way they were handled. And even at a Palm Beach County Commission meeting, of all places, it came up kind of in a way you wouldn't expect. Alexander's going to explain a little bit about that. A couple of weeks ago, during the heat of the Kavanaugh confirmation, the County Commission was what were they discussing exactly?
They were voting on awarding contracts to minority and women-owned businesses, and they were voting on new rules to address that.
Okay, and so an attorney who had some concerns about the measure that was moving forward came before the commission and wanted them to he was opposed, or he wanted them to delay what they were doing. Is that right?
Yeah, because there's a lawsuit that the county is involved in, and so he wanted the county commissioners to delay a vote until that lawsuit is over with.
And let's hear the way he asked for that delay. Joe Forzano is going to cue that up.
Most of us probably watched the hearing last week in D.C. on Thursday, where folks were bantering back and forth. Our U.S. Senate was considering whether or not to make a decision or whether or not a decision should be placed on hold for a brief period of time in order for a due consideration be made and for the FBI to investigate certain allegations concerning Judge Kavanaugh. This board is faced with a similar situation.
So he's saying the county commission and is kind of in the same situation as the United States Senate. How did that go over?
That did not go over well at all. The second clip we have is Palm Beach County Mayor Melissa McKinley responding to that.
But to compare the disparity in public contracting to allegations of sexual assault is a bit distasteful. Please don't come before this board again and compare disparity in public contracting to allegations of sexual assault. Thank you.
Not
asking for any further comment.
No disrespect was intended.
Okay, not a good sign when you're asking the local elected officials for something and they are cutting you off like that. What happened next?
So the third clip we have is from this past Tuesday's county commission meeting, where Mayor McKinley actually apologized to the attorney, and let's hear that first, and then I'll clarify that.
Perhaps I got a little bit passionate on that issue. And so for that, Adam, I just want to apologize for really putting you on the spot.
Okay. So is that the end of the story? She apologized for maybe going after the guy and everybody saying kumbaya, and that's the end of the story, or is it?
That is not the end of the story. So Boynton Beach Vice Mayor Christina Romulus heard McKinley's apology, and during the commission meeting actually emailed Mayor McKinley saying that she was a little disappointed that she apologized. And I can read just a couple lines quickly. Part of her email says, "I was so proud last week when you corrected the individual." And then later in the email, she says, "Unfortunately, as women, I feel at times we tend to care more about the feelings of others rather than standing firm in our convictions. And I feel your apologizing for your comments last week weakened your stance for women. I was saddened."
Wow.
And the mayor responded during lunch.
Oh, go ahead. Question?
I was going to say, it sounds like there's a lot of resistance on that Palm Beach County Commission.
Yeah. So McKinley is kind of getting attacked from both ends. And so what did Mayor McKinley say then?
She wrote back to Vice Mayor Romulus, and she said she did not apologize for the content of her remarks. What she apologized for, and this is a quote, "What I apologize for was the way in which I sent it." She said she was short-fused and terse, and she set a bad example when I cut him off. And she actually, when she told him to stop speaking, she held up her hand and signaled him to stop talking.
Yeah, if you give, and I believe that video we have put on the Palm Beach Post website is probably viral now, right? I guess. But yeah, she kind of waved the hand at him and told him to stop talking. Well, I think, apart from the underlying issue, which might not be of issue to listeners outside of Palm Beach County, I think it is just an interesting illustration of how the, you know, how the passions are still pretty strong on this issue. It reminds me a little bit after the 2000 presidential recount, several of the Palm Beach County commissioners were very involved in that on either side. And before that, the Palm Beach County Commission had not been very partisan. They had a lot of disagreements and stuff, but it wasn't partisan stuff. But after that, there was a big partisan divide for a number of years and some real hard feelings on the Palm Beach County Commission over that. And here you see kind of the same thing going on. What's your, from other county commissioners, do they seem very politically involved one way or another on this issue, Alex?
On this issue, no. This was the first I heard of it. But the interesting thing is Vice Mayor Romulus, her husband, Darren Romulus, works for Palm Beach County Vice Mayor Mac Bernard. So I don't know if there's any involvement there.
A lot of connections there. Well, let me ask you, Zach and John, have you seen other examples of the Kavanaugh confirmation controversy trickling down to local politics?
The Kavanaugh confirmation really divided the country. I mean, Democrats are pretty upset with the way Christine Blasey Ford was treated. But Republicans are also very upset. And over here in the Sarasota area, this is a more Republican area overall. And as the nomination was finishing up, there were some protests or some demonstrations where I saw, pro-Trump folks out there. I saw one woman carrying a sign that said, "I believe Brett Kavanaugh." And I was just interviewing a Republican candidate for the state legislature a couple days ago. And he was telling me that he thinks that the tide is turning in favor of Republicans and that the Kavanaugh nomination has really helped that and fired up Republicans who are upset with the way that he was treated and the way that nomination process unfolded. There was some polling that seemed to show that the enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats had narrowed a little bit during the heart of that confirmation fight. So I do think that it could have an impact on elections overall if either side, gets a little bit more motivated from it.
Yeah, it does seem that, in state races right now, you've seen an example of, Bill Nelson voted against Kavanaugh. Florida's other U.S. Senator, Marco Rubio, did side with the Kavanaugh nomination. But Nelson and Scott scrapped over the nomination earlier this month when they had their first and what now looks like their only debate. But they seem to have moved on since then. Again, that narrow Kavanaugh vote seems to underscore what's at stake in the Florida U.S. Senate race, for example. That's a chamber where every vote carries great meaning. And you can look at just how Obamacare still exists, largely because of a no vote to repeal it last year by now late Senator John McCain. You wonder, does the Kavanaugh drive even more women voters to the Democratic candidate in any race? But then again, you also may have a situation where there are Republicans now motivated in response to that battle.
Definitely something to watch. Now, we're going to talk now about a couple of congressional races in Florida. And the issue has come up if Democrats take control of the House. Some prominent Democrats have suggested reopening the Kavanaugh issue, conducting hearings, into his truthfulness and, I guess ultimately the House can initiate impeachment proceedings against him. One of the hot races over here is in Congressional District 18 between Brian Mast and he's the incumbent Republican and his Democratic challenger, Lauren Bair. And the issue has come up in their race, although at a debate where I was asking questions, I asked specifically about reopening Kavanaugh. Should the House look into the Kavanaugh matter? Because Lauren Bair had said she thought the FBI investigation was not lengthy enough. It's a swing district, and she was kind of careful in answering the question, really didn't address one way or another whether she would support additional House action on that matter. But the Mast and Bair race is one very hot race. And Zach, over in your part of the state is another race that's gotten some attention. That's incumbent Vern Buchanan and his challenger, Democratic challenger. Tell us a little bit about what's the latest in that race.
So this race over here, District 16, has been considered one of the most competitive races in the state. Florida has, four or five competitive races, including the Mast Bair race over there. And people are really looking at these races as, kind of key to whether or not Democrats can take control of the House. They probably need to pick up a few seats here in Florida, potentially. And so this is the District 16 between Vern Buchanan and David Shapiro has been targeted. It was on the Democrats' red to blue program. David Shapiro has raised a ton of money money, over $2 million, which really helped put this race on the map. But there was some developments in the last few days. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee actually canceled some advertising over here, which is a bad sign for Shapiro's campaign. You know, they do this every year. As you get close to the election, the DCCC has to move its money around and prioritize and focus on the races where they think they have the best chance of winning. And it can hang some candidates out to dry a little bit and upset some campaigns. It's not a good sign for the Shapiro campaign. He's continued to raise big money. He raised over $1 million in the third quarter, including some money that he put in. So he has some money, and the DCCC has still invested in the race. They're doing some joint advertising with him. So they haven't completely pulled out. But there were a number of polls, a couple of polls actually, that showed Shapiro down to Vern Buchanan, one by 7 points and one by 9 points. And so you know, the DCCC is prioritizing. I think they're still continuing to advertise over in the masked bear race over there. But it looks like they've pulled some money out of this race. And again, a bad sign for Shapiro as it goes to the election day here.
Yeah. Now the DCCC and the its Republican counterpart, the National Republican Congressional Committee, and a lot of outside groups remain very involved in the District 18 race between Brian Mast and Lauren Baer. And I know I haven't been covering that race on the ground as closely as I have in some of the past election cycles, but I did ask questions at this debate the other night, and it'll air Saturday night if you want to Google it. And I'm on there, but or if you care about the candidates. But the one thing that struck me asking questions in that debate was in their opening, from the opening statements, Brian Mast came out really swinging at Lauren Baer, and you know, certainly suggested that he's concerned about the race and it's close, just judging by the way he came out on the attack from the beginning. So that definitely remains a race to watch. And then there's the two races down in the Miami area. Carlos Curbelo, Republican incumbent in a Democrat-leaning district, he faces a stiff challenge. And then another race that we've talked about before, open seat, where Ileana Ross-Lehtinen is retiring, Republican in Miami. And Democrats have seen that as a big pickup opportunity, but their candidate, Donna Shalala, has disappointed some Democrats with the way she's run her campaign. But that's those are four races to definitely keep an eye on for control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, moving on, we mentioned Ken Starr, and our younger listeners might not remember, but 20 years ago, Ken Starr was the independent counsel investigating then President Bill Clinton. And his investigation, it originally started out over the Whitewater real estate deal and other matters. It eventually came down to focusing on the affair that President Clinton had with an intern, Monica Lewinsky, led to the Republican-controlled House of Representatives to impeach President Clinton on two counts in 1998. But then the Senate did not uphold the impeachment, and President Clinton obviously remained in office. It was obviously a very wrenching time in American history. And Ken Starr was in West Palm Beach recently talking to the Forum Club about some of the impeachment history and also its applications to today, where you have a special counsel, which is different from an independent counsel, but similar. You have special counsel Robert Mueller investigating President Trump and whether there was collusion with Russia in the 2016 presidential race. And Ken Starr, I'm going to play a couple clips here. First, this is what Ken Starr, with the perspective of having led this impeachment investigation 20 years ago, this is Ken Starr, what he thought about impeachment.
You're tearing me apart!
Okay. Well, actually, that's James Dean method acting in Rebel Without a Cause, but it is similar to the sentiment that Ken Starr had. Let's play that actual Ken Starr, somewhat less emotive clip.
But even with that, the nation said no to impeachment. And part of the message that comes out of this, the echo for today, is unless there is a bipartisan consensus that impeachment and removal from office is in fact the way to go, please don't go there. You're simply going to tear the country apart.
Okay. Pretty much what James Dean said. So, okay. So that's Ken Starr's perspective on impeachment. And one other clip, he was asked about the current Mueller investigation and whether President Trump has the authority to shut down the Mueller investigation by having him fired or ordering him to be fired. Here's what Ken Starr had to say about that.
He has the power as the President of the United States to remove any executive branch officers not protected by civil service regulations. And my friend Bob Mueller is on North Line. Former colleague from Whitewater, Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. So he does have the power, the authority to do that. I'll go ahead and answer somewhat gratuitously that I think would be, and I've said this in editorials and in various interviews, a grievous error of judgment on the part of the president to do either of those. He should allow the investigation simply to run its course. Bob Mueller was properly appointed by Rod Rosenstein and has grant authority, and we should just see that through, and hopefully it will be through as soon as possible.
So there you go. The guy who led the impeachment charge 20 years ago is urging restraint based on that experience. He's urging restraint with going forward with anything like that. And also saying that President Trump might have the legal authority, but should refrain and just allow the Mueller investigation to run its course. I thought it was an interesting perspective. Let me ask you guys just very quickly, Zach and John, are you hearing much impeachment talk? I know there's been speculation if the Democrats get control of the House that they might initiate impeachment proceedings against President Trump. Are you hearing that very much out on the campaign trail?
Vern Buchanan, he has been very careful to say that he thinks it's too early to talk about impeachment, that he wants to get the evidence first. I think that, this district, which leans Republican, I think people are skeptical of that. On the flip side, though, Vern Buchanan, the Republican incumbent, has said that he wants to protect Mueller. He thinks Mueller's investigation should go forward and not be disrupted. So you also see some sensitivity there. I think that there is a sense that, the integrity of the Mueller investigation needs to be preserved, and that has, a broad enough support that Republicans aren't willing to go along with Trump and challenge Mueller's legitimacy.
Statewide races, that's pretty much a very hot button issue right now. With it may have a certain appeal among Democratic progressives to push that point, but I think in the way races are so, there's such a toss up right now that it's a little too risky for any Democratic candidate to go too far on that impeachment call.
Definitely. Yeah. You remember in the primary, Democratic primary for governor, Andrew Gillum mentioned his support for impeaching President Trump, but he has not, even before he took the hiatus for the storm, in the general election, he really wasn't mentioning that as much.
Right.
Well, I hear some funky royalty-free music playing again. That's right. Our pick a number segment has returned, and now it's the pick a number reveal. Note takers have been waiting to see what those numbers mean that we talked about earlier. Let's go lowest to highest today. Zach Anderson had the number one. What number one? What does that mean, Zach?
One is the number of debates that we've had in Florida's high profile U.S. Senate race, a key Senate race that could determine who controls the chamber. And we've only had one debate, and we're not going to have any more because the candidates couldn't agree on another debate. They postponed a debate that was supposed to be on CNN this week, and then they couldn't agree on a date that they would do it. And so there's only going to be one debate in this high profile race. And to me, that's unacceptable. I think it's a disservice to voters. People deserve to hear more from these candidates. They deserve to hear them and to see them up and close next to each other, debating key issues for the state. And the only debate that they did have was on a Spanish station that was dubbed in Spanish so that most people couldn't listen to it if they didn't understand Spanish. So I just think that it's unfortunate that they couldn't have put those differences aside and just done something that I think is a basic public service in an election like this.
All right. Strong take on that. Number one. Okay. Then our next number is 14, and that's from Alexander Seltzer. What's that number 14 signify?
14 is the number of days you can vote early. Early voting starts Monday, October 22nd, and ends Sunday, November 4th. And I picked this topic because election supervisors, including Palm Beach County's Susan Booker, are encouraging early voting because of what some are calling an ugly ballot. The ballot is filled with text, especially with the 12 amendments, and voters are being encouraged to get familiar with the amendments before going to the polls. Voting early and researching the amendments beforehand will reduce long lines on election day.
Very good point. Yeah, you don't want to be in some line on election day because a guy's waiting to read all those amendments for the first time, right? So there, right. There you go. Common problem. Okay, John Kennedy had the number 125.
Yes, 125 is as in $125 million. And that's what Rick Scott has now taken from his own family's wealth and put into campaigns as he's won two elections for governor, and now he's running for U.S. Senate. Scott spent $86 million in his first two governor's races, and at that time it was more than $70 million in the first time around when he was more of an unknown. But last month he put another $18 million into this U.S. Senate race, according to new campaign finance disclosure reports, and that brings his spending total now to $39 million in this race from his own pocket. That accounts for 70% of what his campaign has raised so far. For a little perspective on that $125 million spent, that's just slightly under the county budgets of Gadsden, Gulf, and Holmes counties combined. Those three of those counties are among those that are still reeling from Hurricane Michael. And, you know, we still have some time to go in this Senate race, so you wonder how much more will he pony up.
Wow. Two Gadsden County references in one podcast.
That's a rarity.
My number was 677,436. That is the number of people 19 days before Election Day. That's the number of people who have already cast ballots in Florida. Those are vote by mail. That's even before early voting begins. You have almost 700,000 people have already voted. And for a little perspective, that is more people. That's roughly the number of people that voted in the entire state of Idaho in the 2016 presidential election. And it's more people than voted in nine states in the 2016 presidential election. So campaigns continue. Millions of dollars are being spent on advertising. But for 677,436 people, they have already cast their ballots in Florida. Well, that concludes our podcast. We thank you for listening, as always. Once again, I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. It's been my honor to host. And here in studio, we've had our special guest, Palm Beach Post staff writer Alexandra Seltzer. We've also been capably assisted by the team Corzano of Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano. We've also been joined by Zach Anderson, the politics editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, and by Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy in Tallahassee, and of course, the man behind the curtain, Adam Fish, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Thank you.